Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. Help find your own truth by exploring perspectives you won't find in the mainstream on some of life's biggest mysteries. Whether it's grand conspiracies, breakaway societies, UFOs, ancient civilizations, lost wisdom, as well as the paranormal, all at your fingertips. Stream videos anywhere from your living room or on the go with the Gaia app, available through the App Store or Google Play, which gives you access to over 7,000 titles, all available to you with a monthly plan for only $9.95 a month. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents. There are multiple plans to choose from, including a 3-month plan and an annual plan. You'll have access to incredible shows available only on Gaia, like Truth Hunter, Buzzsaw, Cosmic Disclosure, Beyond Belief, Missing Links, Hidden Origins, and Deep Space, and much, much more. Gaia is available on your Android or iPhone, Roku, Apple TV, and Amazon Fire TV. If you enjoy expanding your perspective, then you'll enjoy Gaia.com. That's GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. All one word, folks. GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Let's start the show. Howdy, everybody, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives today with me, Cam Hale, and as always, the great beast himself.
That's me.
Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? I'm glad to be here in studio. It's a warm day, but it's beautiful. The weather's beautiful. It's almost time for the 4th of July. I've got a large swimming party we're going to. We're going to be grilling, binge drinking, splashing, doing jackknives, cannonballs. Who knows?
The flying squirrel.
We're going to be playing dominoes. We're going to be, you know, setting off explosives. Just the good fun things.
Yeah.
So I'm getting ramped up for that because that's going to be here in less than just a couple days from now.
Hopefully you come back with, well, at least your thumbs.
Yeah.
And you know, it's okay if you blow off a pinky finger, the tip of one. It's fine if you lose those, but just don't lose the thumbs. You know what I mean? That's what really separates us.
Yeah, you're right. Because if you like lose like your second finger or something, you can still open up a pickle jar and stuff, but you ain't got no thumb.
If you lost one of your pinkies, how horrible would it really be?
I don't know. It doesn't really do much.
Do you put it in your ear, like when you scratch?
Yeah, that's about it.
Okay. So one thing the pinky finger does, right? What else? I mean, if you lost a thumb, how are you going to button your pants? How are you going to hold your drinks? Yeah. How are you going to tell people at the gas pumps that they suck? Because Kyle loves to give people the thumbs down. Kyle has changed his ways, folks. Let me lay this on y'all.
Oh, no.
Yeah, let me lay this on y'all. He used to suffer. As he's gotten older, it's gotten better. But for years, he suffered from road rage. Road rage of... Shut up. Sit over there and shut up. You know it's true. So he would suffer from road rage where I'd be on the phone with him and he's cursing and yelling at them. And I can only imagine other things. The one finger, the two finger English way, whatever it is. He has completely outgrown that, and now he's gone to amusing himself by when people do it and glare at him. If they cut him off and all, Kyle doesn't get mad anymore. Kyle simply looks at him, puts his hand either out the window or right up to the glass, and gives him the thumbs down and gives him this with his tongue.
when he sees them. Yeah. He'll do it. Yeah. Nothing is more childish and slapping. It's like a slap in the face when a grown man does that to you.
You should have seen the look on the guy. Okay, so I was at a gas station, fueling up my car, and I'm just sitting there waiting for it to fill up, not really doing anything. And here comes this guy on this Harley. You're talking about an older man. He's probably about 55, a little bit overweight. He's got a jacket on that's too small. Mind you, it's like a leather vest. It's too small for him. It's probably cheap, Chinese leather. It's just garbage. He thinks he's Billy Badass is what he thinks. He thinks he's cool. So he just starts, he gets on his bike. I guess he had a soft drink or something. And he starts it up, and then he just starts rapping on it and looking at me. I'm like, was he looking at somebody behind me? He's just looking at me, revving his motorcycle. Like, I guess I'm supposed to be impressed. I simply stuck my hand out and I gave him the thumbs down. And you should have seen his face. He looked completely shocked.
Well, because you didn't tell him the whole story, is he left the thumb up for just a second to give the man hope. And when the guy went to nod, that's when he hit him with the thumbs down like he's Caesar. Nope.
I'm like, I'm not impressed. Not impressed.
It's because you're an ass.
Well, he's being juvenile as well, trying to, wrap the pipes to impress me. I'm not impressed, dude. I'm not 10.
Yeah.
Get out of here. It's
now
garbage.
Kyle has adopted this. So Kyle has adopted the thumbs down. So, folks, if you want to change your ways, if you want to have a little fun with people, just adopt the thumbs down.
Just give them thumbs down.
Yeah, no more fingers, no more yelling, no more getting mad. Just smirk at them, shake your head, and give them the thumbs down.
I wish Facebook and Instagram stuff had the thumbs down.
Oh, you have no idea.
They have the thumbs up. Why can't I give it the thumbs down?
Yeah, if I want a thumbs down button bad.
You get some stupid quote they're trying to send you? I want a thumbs down it.
Thumbs down.
It doesn't mean we can't be friends. I just don't like that.
That's right.
Or some product to kind of push on you. I love that. You'll get a friend request from somebody you knew a long time ago, and you're like, huh, well, all right. And then within like a couple days, they start sending you stuff. Well, I sell these cosmetics now. You should really, can I come to your house? And say, you're like, no.
What they're saying is you're ugly.
This is a sales pitch. Oh, there's no doubt about that. Anyways.
So how was your weekend?
Pretty good. We started out another baseball tournament. We lost 4-3 the first game. And then we had two games on the next day, but unfortunately it rained a lot, so we didn't get to play. So
we've got it put off till right now. Now, we watched some good fights last night.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because, folks, for y'all that always guess, we try to record this as close to Mondays. Right now this is a Sunday afternoon that we've knocked all this out at because it's hot. We don't want to get outside and do anything. We watched some amazing fights last night. We're getting ready for the fights coming up. I think Bellator did a great job. But, we've been talking off air about my trip. That's right, folks. I survived the Brazos River. Wow, what a beating. I've got some video footage. I'm going to be putting it together so we can release it so y'all can get a good laugh at some of the stuff that went down. But I will let you know how it all went. 103 degrees. 103 degrees on the river. Yeah. We were going to launch a little earlier, and then I didn't know this. My son had let it slip out. He'd been working a bunch, like, all week. Like, he's had the last 3 days about 8 hours of sleep over the last 3 days, and he'd been working over in Dallas in some operating rooms in the middle of the night doing some electrical work and stuff over there. So I didn't tell him, so I didn't get him up super early like we were planning on to leave Friday morning. So I let him sleep in, being the soft-hearted dad sometimes. So after we got up and we milled around and went and got breakfast and had our stuff loaded and all that, we made our way out there. So we didn't launch until right at, I would say, 10 o'clock Friday morning. And we did some fishing. Didn't catch anything worth, bragging about. A bunch of little stuff here and there, but nothing big, nothing fun. We saw a ton of rough fish, a lot of gar, a lot of carp, some drum. A few striper were caught down through there, but some bass, and things along those lines. And then when the heat hit, we were paddling, and it got so bad. Y'all aren't going to believe this. I even said on the video, y'all aren't going to believe this. I was actually neck deep in the Brazos River with my kayak tied to me for 3 miles, pushing along the bottom, just to not overheat. This was a ridiculous amount of heat. But anyway, we went about 12 or 13 miles the first day, that Friday. And we made our camp, and we thought that was it, right? We made camp. It was close to 6 o'clock. We got our stuff done. Everything pitched up. We were going to make dinner, the whole deal. And it was supposed to be scattered storms that day, Friday evening. 60% chance of scattered storms. They lied. The only place it was scattered was right on top of us. About between 4 and 5 a.m., the storms blew in Saturday morning. About 20, 25 mile an hour winds whipping down through that river bottom. rain driving in under my tarp all up on me while I was in my hammock. Lightning was crashing. You could hear limbs breaking in the dark, and we heard a tree break over about 100 yards just due south of where we were camping. It was wild. Lightning was crashing. We ended up breaking camp in the driving rain, packed up, and was on the water again by about 7:30, 7:45, and we were having to paddle along the banks, and every now and again, lightning would strike, but, you know, we were like, what are we going to do? You're either going to get hit, or you're going to have to wait it out for who knows how long.
And you don't want the river coming up, too, you know?
And it had came up a little bit. It had came up overall, I'd probably say 6 to 10 inches. It had already rolled, you know, rose a little from that point from all the runoff and everything that was coming in. So it was flowing a little bit better. And we made really good time. We was out of that sucker. I mean, we made a really good time. First of all, with the wind at your back, cooler weather in the rain, we were out of that puppy by, I don't know, 11?
Really?
Yeah, so we were cruising. I mean, we made it. It was perfect. We had a great trip. Everything was fun. A good little practice run, like I said. It's all getting ready for next month. So, yeah, I mean, it was a really, really good trip. And I'm going to use that to segue into a better trip, folks. From LifeScience.com, if we're going to talk about trips, you remember me bringing up, Kyle, the Hyperloop. Remember we're talking about this?
This is Elon Musk, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. About how they were going to basically put you in one of those things that you get at the bank and shoot you across the continent, right?
Yeah, it was something like that. And I also saw plans for like some kind of cart or something. Your car actually goes on and that
whole cart shoots
you through this tube.
And then you can just drive out and go again. Yes.
They are currently constructing this tube right now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a real thing.
Well, this, get a load of this. This is going to be called the Hyperloop Hotel. And they claim, this is Casey Deemer, staff writer there at Live Science, says this, that it could be the future of luxury travel, a new design concept that aims to combine the luxury of a hotel room with a high-speed rail system could make traveling between U.S. cities faster and far more comfortable. That's right, folks. A combination of this. The mobile Hyperloop Hotel idea was recently announced as the student winner of the 2017 Radical Innovation Award. Now, this is a competition for new ideas in hospitality. Never knew of such a thing.
No.
The Hyperloop Hotel is the vision of Brandon Sybrick, and he's a graduate architectural student at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, so from UNLV. Now, through the Hyperloop, a transportation system in which passenger-filled pods are accelerated through low-pressure tubes to their destination, is still in the development phases by several companies. And Brandon there, he thinks it's the next big innovation in transportation. In fact, he was inspired by the startup Hyperloop One, which, of course, like we were talking about, is beginning its construction on a full-scale test track known as DevLoop there in the Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Brandon told Live Science. He says, I wanted to explore ways in which this technology could transform the overall travel experience and branch into hospitality. Now, guests can travel to any hotel destination within the network and even visit multiple destinations in a single day. Now, rather than passenger-carrying pods like train cars, which is what I was assuming it was all going to be like, right?
Right.
Kind of like just a faster-moving train or
That's
a pod.
That's kind of what I thought.
Yeah. Now, he says this, that the Hyperloop Hotel would use repurposed shipping containers as suites that travel through the Hyperloop network.
Like when he says shipping containers, like those Connex boxes?
Yep. Yeah. Uh-huh. And he says at each destination city, the suites would dock at a modular hotel. The whole concept relies on modular design, ranging from suites themselves to hotel towers made up of suites and permanent amenities. Now, this is all according to Brandon Sybrick. Now, he says that the design relies on a Hyperloop transportation network that could accommodate these container suites. Now, he said the construction costs for these hotels would vary, but he's guessing around or estimating between $8 and $10 million. But this is what it is. The Hyperloop Hotel, if it comes true, said would cost passengers about $1,200 per trip. That's including travel and a one-night stay. Now, this is it. This is an average cost estimate, meaning travel to nearby destinations could cost less than this number, and travel to cities further apart, of course, could cost a little bit more.
Right, yeah, makes sense.
Now, he says this, that in its beginning stages, this experience is marketed to the business elite. Now, hopefully in the future, costs for this technology will lower to accommodate the average traveler. Now, his initial proposal for this is 13 destinations here in the U.S., Austin, Texas, Boston, Chicago, Denver, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, Nashville, New York, Portland, San Francisco, Santa Fe, and then Seattle and Washington. Now, he says that the network could expand to more destinations in the U.S. as well as link cities to Europe or Asia. Now, it goes on to talk about that he, you know, by winning the student award in this year's Radical Innovation Competition, he received a cash prize and a scholarship opportunity there at UNLV. So, you know, it says that his Hyperloop hotel concept is also going to be a highlighted part of an upcoming event this October. And he's part of this professional group now that there's going to be from three more finalists in this whole group. So I never even, you talk about people thinking outside the box, no pun intended with this Connex box travel thing. But think about how easy it would be as if, say, if you wanted to go to, let's say, Europe. And instead of trying to book a hotel room or do anything like that or any of these things, you go to wherever you're, say, New York or L.A. or, say, Austin. We drove down to Austin. Okay, we're going to go to London. Well, we don't have to book a room. We get our Connex box, you know, that's already, we get it the way we want it. We need king size beds. We need this. We need that. It's all built in it. We load up, you know, you pack in, you get in it. They load you into the Hyperloop. Now they ship you over there, basically.
Right.
You're unloaded and you're stored modularly. Now you have that room. You leave that room, you get out, you stay in London a week or two. That's your hotel room. When you get done, you get back in it and then it ships you back across here. And then now it's back. It's kind of like a U-Haul or a rental, but it's like a U-Haul for staying overnight.
It's pretty cool. When you were listing the cities that they were trying to, I agree with almost all of those except when it came to our state. I don't think if they were going to build something, they would go to Austin, just because Austin is, much like many states in our country, is the capital of our state, but it's not near as big as close to the biggest cities in our state. Like, I would think they would build one in Houston first.
Well, he may not know that.
You know what I'm saying?
He's just calling out what he knows. Right. Yeah.
Austin's a cool place, very cool, but it's not huge. It's only got a population of about 900,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they're going to do something where Houston has like 2.5 million, I think it would come to a larger city. You know, he mentioned San Francisco.
Well, and that's what Chicago, he's talking about. New York, Boston. But it also may be something that there may be a lot more business travel down there.
That's
for
possible.
What he does. You know, I don't know. But yeah, I think he was just throwing some names out there and all that stuff for things to make it. But you know what? That is a heck of an idea. These are those little scratches on the surface of things whenever we're talking about using all this technology, like we've talked about the robot uprising. And these are little things that are coming along that I don't think that we've ever thought of. Because if you start doing that, then that in turn affects the hotel industry then.
Yep, you're right.
So, yeah, it gets wild.
That's pretty cool. Speaking of cool, check this out. Archaeologists excavating a site in eastern Ethiopia have found evidence of a mythical city of giants, which was a thriving center of commerce between the 10th and 15th centuries. Throughout modern history, residents of nearby areas believe the city might have been built and inhabited by giants due to the impossibly large size of some of the stone blocks which made up the city walls and some of the buildings. Researchers have found evidence that the city had well-established trade with Egypt, India, and China, which could rewrite much of what we know about the ancient Ethiopian history. The site measures close to 1 square kilometer, and so far, excavations have turned up a mosque built in the 12th century, Islamic burial sites with over 300 sets of remains, and scores of pottery from as far away as China and even Madagascar. A small hoard of glass beads has also been found, Cam, a clear indication that this was once an economic center which traded with faraway lands. Now, the expedition was led by Professor Timothy Insole from the Institute of Arabic and Islamic Studies at the University of Exeter. And according to Insole, this discovery could shine light on a completely new chapter of the history of all of Eastern Africa. It said that farmers had been finding strange objects, including these Chinese coins, throughout the years as they were working on their land. And a legend began that the area was home to giants because, I guess, the city walls and some of the buildings are, you know, created with what they thought was impossibly huge stones. We've seen this in many pre-Diluvian cities and things like that. That have these giant rocks, but we know that it wasn't created by giants. It was created by people. But so they don't want the legendary site is called the City of Giants, but it's kind of a play on words. It's because some of the locals thought it was. They didn't actually find like a city where the doorways were like 15 foot tall, and then they found a skeleton of giants. None of that happened. It's just, you know, it's a play on words. But anyway, either way, there's this city, an ancient city found in eastern Ethiopia, and they could tell that even back then they were trading with different parts of the world. So it's just like we've talked about hundreds of times on this show. For whatever reason, you're taught in school in history that these cultures didn't have contact with each other, and it's just not so.
Yeah.
And so this looked like a major city, a major shipping area where people could come. They were finding coins from different parts of the world, pottery from different
That's
parts
awesome.
Of the world, glass beads. Who knows what's there?
That's
when
awesome.
You dig around, you might really find some interesting stuff. So I thought that was pretty cool.
I'd get a kick out of it, well, like we've talked about, where they just unearth and find more and more things showing that we all pretty much still knew each other. Even back then with all the travel, yeah, we still knew each other.
Yeah.
I've got something here. We're going to go along the same lines of discovery. Now, you can find this anywhere. I pulled this down off of the Daily Mail, but you can find it at Shreveport Times. You can pretty much dig it up anywhere online if you want to search this up, folks. This is interesting, though. A couple find the largest ever intact Native American canoe, measuring 33 feet and dating back to 1,000 years. And they noticed it when it was poking out of the mud on a Louisiana riverbank.
That's cool.
Right?
1,000 years old, it's been preserved.
Yes.
I'm surprised that the things that lasted.
Oh, the pictures are amazing of it. Yeah, it's amazing. It says two people were walking along a riverbank and they stumbled across an ancient Native American dugout canoe that they believe. Now, I think they hit it between 800 and 1,000 years is what they say. But Robert Cornett and Gina Bradle noticed this 2 weeks ago in the mud on the Red River of north of Shreveport there in Louisiana. Now, the canoe weighs close to 1,000 pounds. It's 3 foot wide and thought to be the largest ever found intact in the U.S. Now, it's made by digging out a cypress tree. So they basically took the cypress tree, you know, and dug it out. And they also say that it's made by the Caddo Indians that were down in that area. And it's in excellent condition. Here's the one thing. One side of it, if you look at the picture, all one side of it is missing. So it's like the one
I'm
side.
Seeing it just, now.
You see yep. it. You check it out. Mm-hmm. How awesome is it still, though?
That's pretty cool. And the guy that found it's awesome. He's got a Def Leppard t-shirt
on. Oh, yeah, yeah. And his girl's got the Pepsi Cola t-shirt on and whatnot. Yeah. Now, they came across this after their Mr. Cornett, it says, who decided to take some time off work for a little boat trip on his birthday. Now, archaeologist Jeffrey Girard from the Louisiana Archaeological Society and Robert Chip from the State Archaeological Division excavated the boat. Now, of course, Jeffrey Girard said a similar canoe was found locally in 1983, and this one is now on display at the Louisiana State Exhibit Museum there in Shreveport. And he said this, it's not common to find them. It's only the second one we've ever found in this area. And they're both very similar to one another and very large. Now, it says here that the pair came across this find after Mr. Cornett, like I said, decided to take some time off for a boat trip for his birthday. They look down, you know, and could you imagine just kicking down through there, looking down, and you're like, they see just part of it sticking out of this creek bank. So they go and dig around. They're like, what is that? Now, the coolest thing is this. It's been taken to Texas A&M, where they're going to, you know, basically study it, but also they're going to clean it and go through the whole thing to try to conserve as much every little bit pieces they can.
Right.
They say it's probably going to take 2 years to clean this thing properly and to save this where they can actually put it.
Well, you know, waterways are very, and people have been using waterways throughout mm-hmm. history. So that's why I always say when you're out on the on a river or something, be looking around. You never know what you might come across.
Yes.
And when you look at this boat, this canoe, you know, it basically was a large log at one point and they yep. had to hand carve out the inside. Imagine how long that took.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of them, they would burn it. They would start a fire, burn it, and hew it out.
Oh, become
burn
softer,
it
and hew
it out. Well, they would just, as it burns, they just cut out what they need and let it continue to burn it down and dig it out that way. A lot of them would do it that way. The cool thing is this. The landowner, that the land where they found it, donated it to the state, the whole thing. They
That's
said,
cool.
yeah, go ahead and take it, you know, this whole deal. It's funny you bring up the whole waterway. My son was talking about a lot after we pitched camp and after we got done, is he was like, man, I can't imagine what it would be like portaging large ships. Like, can you imagine like Viking ships and all that stuff coming up those rivers and it's not deep enough, so then all the men have to get out with ropes and start pulling and dragging to get those ships along there.
Well, sometimes they couldn't. I mean, sometimes yeah. they literally had to pitch camp and wait until the water or a big rainfall came yep. or something and the river would rise and they would go because, like you're saying, some
couldn't
of those boats
move.
Are too big to move and yeah. they had too big a distance.
And then he was laughing about not knowing what would be around the corner.
That'd
Imagine
be
being out in the middle of nowhere. You're like, that's where that adventuresome spirit. He's like, I could understand it. He's like, because I just want to paddle a little further. I just want to know what's right around that bend. What's over there?
The giant ice wall.
Yeah. So
that's what you run into. The giant ice wall.
Right. Yeah.
Speaking of ice, that would be really nice. But it's very hot here in Texas. And on today's show, I'm going to be talking about the heat, folks. I'm going to be talking about some strange and unusual sightings that's taken place in deserts from around the world. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. We'll be right back.
Well, it's summer here in Texas, which means it's hot. Most weekends are spent around a swimming pool, or out at the lake, or even the river. When the heat rises, I can't help but to think about the desert. You know, a desolate and barren place. Deserts seem to lie somewhere in another realm, beyond time and reality. They can become quite the scary place, remote, deadly, and remorseless, posing challenges for life that has evolved there, and for anyone foolhardy enough to enter this domain unprepared. Every year, countless hikers, backpackers, and campers, for multiple reasons, die in the desert. Just a couple years ago, UFC fighter Evan Tanner died while camping in a rugged area of Imperial County near the California-Arizona border. It appears he was underprepared and died from exposure. Little water and 115-degree days with little cover can cause problems even for the most experienced. Deserts are a dangerous place, and believe it or not, are riddled with strange and supernatural activity. From spectral evil to ferocious, mysterious beasts, the deserts of the world offer many strange things, and on today's show, I'm going to share with you some of these incredible tales. Let's begin with some ghostly tales of phantoms and spirits, spectral stagecoaches, and dead train robbers, and even lost miners. In a place called Yaqui Well, in the deserts of America's Southwest, there apparently lies a very unusual event that takes place for those lucky enough, or perhaps unlucky enough, to witness. In this desolate place, three ghostly entities are said to emerge and dance about on nights with a full moon. The story behind the dancing ghosts begins with three immigrants to the area who arrived at the well after almost dying of thirst on their journey to find a short route through the desert from Yuma to California. Upon reaching the well, one of the immigrants died soon after drinking from the well, and his companions noticed some gold nuggets fall out of the dead man's pocket. Unsure of where the gold had come from, the two remaining men soon became overwhelmed with greed, and heated argument ensued, during which one of the men drowned his companion in the well. An Indian, who had been watching the violent fiasco, reported that the remaining man went into a delirious frenzy and ran off into the desert, maniacally shouting, "Gold! Gold!" before disappearing forever. It is said that on hot summer nights with a full moon, one of the dead men rises from the muddy waters of the well. Another appears from the surrounding brush, and soon after, the other arrives on a cool breeze from the desert, after which they join hands and dance around the well before disappearing, leaving the area much chillier than its surroundings. One of the scarier phantoms of the desert is an apparition that takes on the appearance of an 8-foot-tall glowing skeleton with a lantern in its chest, which roams the Badlands between Superstition Mountain and 17 Palms in the state of Arizona. This rather frightening and monstrous specter was reportedly first seen way back in the 1800s by a prospector, rather appropriately named Charlie Arizona. Mr. Arizona was settling down in his camp for the night when he heard his burros acting up on the edge of camp. When the prospector went to investigate, he reportedly saw a huge skeleton, 8 feet tall, with a lantern glowing through his ribcage, shambling about the desert. The sinister apparition was described as seemingly looking for something out among the scrub brush, which it did for some time before wandering off and over a ridge. The skeleton was then seen several more times by people camping out in the desert, and two adventurous young men decided to actually go out in search of the thing. After spending 3 nights in the desert looking for it, the glowing ghost skeleton finally appeared out in the desert, wandering around aimlessly, at first making itself known as merely a bobbling, inexplicable light, but clearly the specter on closer inspection. The adventurers fired at it with their rifles, but the wraith was impervious to their gunfire and continued on its way unfazed. The two men allegedly followed the skeleton for 3 miles through rugged terrain before they lost it in a canyon.
Locals believe that the ghostly skeleton was the spirit of a miner looking for his lost secret mine. A potent local legend has long been that of Peg Leg Smith's lost mine, a lost mine full of gold that has been a quarry of many ultimately failed expeditions to find it. Another well-known story is that of the Lady in White of the mining town Velasito in Calaveras County, California. The story goes that an ill young woman arrived here by stage in the late 1850s on her way to Sacramento to meet up with her lover. Because of the ravages of the travel and malnutrition and lack of water, they all took their toll on the woman, and although townsfolk tried their best to save her, she soon perished. When the bag she had been carrying was examined, among the various belongings was found an immaculate laced brand new white dress that was speculated to have been her wedding dress. The dead woman was dressed in the clothes and buried at Campo Santo near the stage station. Since that time, the ghostly woman has been often seen on moonless nights wandering around the town in her white dress. Although this ghost is not known to be malicious, she is reported to install a distinct sense of unease and fear in all those that see her. Velasito also has the distinction of being the lair of a spectral horse that holds the key to a long-lost desert treasure. It all started with the botched holdup of a stagecoach on its way to Velasito Station, carrying an estimated $65,000 in cash. As the four would-be robbers made their escape, the stagecoach driver fired at them and took one of the men down. Oddly, the driver found two bodies. We only expected to find one, and surmised that one of the bandits had probably killed a member of its own party, possibly so that he could have a larger share of the loot. The two remaining thieves made their way into the desert wasteland and buried their loot before heading back into town to have drinks. It is at this point that the two are said to have had a drunken argument, and the bandit leader went to go get his white horse, after which he barged into the establishment atop the horse and maliciously shot his partner, who, before dying, managed to shoot back and kill the horse-mounted leader of the gang. The horse, spooked by loud gunfire, fled into the desert and was never seen again, at least alive. The story goes that if anyone approaches the secret stash of loot, the ghost of the white horse will come stampeding out of the desert to chase them away before vanishing into thin air. Not far from the Velasito stage station is another supposedly haunted locale, a place called Carrizo Wash. It is said that a ghostly stagecoach, known as the Phantom Stage, can be seen from time to time blazing across the desert, pulled by a team of four spectral mules and driven by a mysterious hunched-over, shadowy figure. The ghostly stagecoach is said to slow down by where Carrizo Station once stood, only to seemingly realize that it's not there anymore, and then continue on to into the desert badlands. A spooky element of the story is that the Phantom Stage is said to leave behind actual rut marks from its wheels, as well as the footprints of the mules. Many people have come forward and have taken pictures of these. You can find them online. The Phantom Stagecoach has been linked to another legend of the area, that of the lost treasure of gold coins that was carried within a stagecoach during the 1860s. Legends has it that a stagecoach was loaded with gold coins and headed out from El Paso on its way to San Diego. When in the vicinity of the Fish and Coyote Mountains near Yuma, Arizona, it was held up once again by robbers. The robbers shot the driver dead, who slumped over in his seat. The stage then apparently continued on as the spooked horses dragged it on and into the desert, where it disappeared into the desolate Badlands forever. There are those who believe that the Phantom Stagecoach is the ghostly incarnation of this stagecoach, eternally looping about its original route. Perhaps even more bizarre is a phantom vehicle, and it's reported from the coastal desert region of Brazil's northern region of Maranhão. Who even knew Brazil had a desert? Here, there is said to be a spectral phantom jeep that the locals refer to as Caburé, which tears through the harsh wasteland where there are no roads and the brush-strewn rocky gulches that even a good off-road vehicle would have a difficult time navigating.
the phantom vehicle is said to drive about aimlessly and sometimes race around doing donuts out in the barren landscape. The ghostly Jeep is said to have headlights that can become dazzlingly bright, bright enough to blind eyewitnesses, and that the blue tinted illumination is known to light up the desert as if it was broad daylight. The Jeep apparently has a mischievous streak, with the rather disconcerting habit of bearing down on any witnesses as if to run them over, only to vanish right before impact, leaving the victim terrified. The Mangareyes River of the area also has stories of a mysterious phantom boat, or boats, that are said to similarly put themselves on collision courses with other fishing boats, only to disappear right before colliding with them. There are other sightings, not just of the dead, but of the living. Many people have claimed to see giant snakes in many deserts throughout the world. Now moving across over to the Sahara Desert, we find bizarre stories of giant desert snakes prowling the wastelands in the desert's northern reaches. Desert nomads of the area have long spoken of enormous, monstrous serpents up to 4 meters long, known to the locals as Teguerga, which are said to be venomous and capable of devouring goats, sheep, and even camels. In the 1950s, nomads reported a large number of incidents involving the giant snakes and appealed to colonial authorities for help. A French army detachment was allegedly sent out into the desert sands near a place called Beni Anouf in an effort to track down the beasts. According to the reports, the French contingent came across a snake that was 20 meters long, so large that it required machine gun fire to kill it. The skin was allegedly kept, but was later lost. This is not the only reported skin of the creatures to have been found. In the same area, a local man allegedly shot and killed a snake measuring a dazzling 15 feet long that had horns and a crest of hair on its head. The bizarre creature's skin was apparently exhibited for a while before it was purchased by a private collector for a reported 45,000 francs and has not been seen since. The giant mystery snakes were seen again in 1967 when a bulldozer operator by the name of Hamaza Rahmani was working on the construction of a dam in Morocco and spotted what appeared to be a 9-meter-long snake with a mane of hair on its head that was rather oddly eating, of all things, engine grease. The startled bulldozer driver allegedly rammed the thing with the bulldozer blade and killed it. The construction site was apparently a popular haunt for the creatures because several more were subsequently seen in the vicinity. A 10-meter-long snake with horns was again seen in 1968, and another 15-meter-long one was spotted again in 1969. It is not known what happened to the body of the serpent that was allegedly killed by Rahmani. But it's not just giant snakes, folks. Believe it or not, there have actually been sightings of Sasquatch in the desert. I know what you're thinking. How can that be? Well, I'm the same way. But apparently, there's a type of Sasquatch that lives in the desert and is very aggressive and irritable. In the sun-scorched burning wilderness of a place called Borrego Sink, 45 miles southeast of Borrego Springs, California, there have been reported terrifying encounters between man and a mysterious beast. The desert may seem to be a strange place to find Bigfoot, but not only have they been reported in this savage wasteland, but they seem to be of a rather aggressive variety, especially the ones that have come to be known as the Borrego Sasquatch. One such incident occurred in 1939, when a man was camping alone, kind of like Cam does from time to time, in one of the many dry gulches of the area. The man was awakened in the middle of the night by a band of two-legged, hairy creatures stalking around his campground on the fringes of the campfire's light. The beasts were described as having white or silver fur and possessed piercing red eyes that actually glowed in the dark. The pack of creatures circled the camp menacingly for some time, but seemed to be somewhat afraid of the fire, so they kept their distance until they finally slunk back into the desert night. Some 30 years later, in the same region, a man by the name of Harold Lancaster had his own frightening encounter as he was camping in the sink. Lancaster described how an enormous, hair-covered, bipedal creature stalked out of the wilderness and lumbered straight towards him at an intimidating manner. The man, fearing that he was about to be attacked, fired his revolver into the air in an effort to scare the monster away. Whatever the creature was, the gunshots did the trick, and the thing reportedly jumped around 3 feet into the air before glaring at it, Lancaster, and running off into the bush. Borrego Sink is not the only place in the desert with its share of ominous man-beasts. In a place called Dead Man's Hole, located 7 miles from Warner Springs, off Highway 79, a string of vicious, unsolved murders occurred back in the 19th century that have long been blamed on a malicious, marauding group of Sasquatch. In 1858, the first victim was killed under very mysterious circumstances, followed by more slayings over the years. A Frenchman who was slaughtered in his cabin, a prospector named David Blair who was killed by what looked like a knife attack, and a woman named Belinda who was strangled and then mutilated. The story may have just been chalked up to an insane killer on the rampage had it not been for a curious story that surfaced in 1888. See, then, two hunters were out hunting in an area known as Dark Canyon when they came across a cave full of scattered remains of various mutilated animals. As they investigated the cave, the hunters reported being attacked by a huge, man-like beast covered in matted black hair with huge hands and huge feet. According to the hunters, they opened fire on the beast and killed it, after which its body was apparently moved to San Diego and shown to the police. Now, at the time, a paper called the San Diego Union ran the story and claimed that the rampaging mystery creature had been the one responsible for the murders, causing quite a public stir in the process. Oddly, the paper ran a story the following day, dismissing the article as a mere April Fool's joke. It is unknown if there ever really was a body or not, or if the creature really existed. But what is known is that the mysterious murders remained unsolved. Another strange case involving some sort of humanoid creature comes from the deserts of the Mexican state of Chihuahua. At the end of 1989 and the beginning of 1990, a group of teenagers were on a mission to explore the caves of a place called Cerro Pajarito when they came across something that would haunt them for the rest of their lives. As the group was exploring one of the caves, they came upon this discovery of a dead deer and a doe that were freshly killed and exhibited 3 odd perforations on their necks that formed kind of a triangular pattern. In the surrounding area, there were footprints that looked like those of a puma or mountain lion, but it soon became apparent that no puma or large cat had done this. The group suddenly heard blood-curdling squealing sounds, and the air became pervaded by a stench described as smelling kind of like burning wood. The terrified group of teenagers looked and saw a hunched-over, humanoid figure crouched upon a rock outcropping about 15 meters away from them. The creature apparently started bounding towards them, and one of the groups emptied his pistol at it, although the bullets seemed to have no effect. As the panicked group turned tail and ran for their life, they reported passing yet another humanoid creature that was described as being metallic green in color and standing only about 80 centimeters high. Now that's strange. The desert is an eerie and scary place at times. For among the eternal shifting sands and unchanging landscape lurk mysterious animals and spectral apparitions that roam the barren badlands, the gullies, the ridges, and the scrubland of these forgotten places. Deserts are a good place for mysteries. Perhaps it's because not too many people live there, or because for most of human existence, crossing a desert was a dangerous ordeal. And so, over time, legends and strange tales were created to keep people out. Or is it because people are not around? These specters, these strange creatures, choose to reside in the desert due to lack of options. I don't know, but if you're ever in the desert, be careful. There may just be something more sinister than just the heat and lack of water. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
We're back with Expanded Perspectives. Yeah, believe it or not, it turns out that there's crazy sightings in the desert. And, you know, even of Sasquatch. And you don't think of Sasquatch being in the desert. And apparently he's very irritable. But maybe it's because of the heat. He's got all that hair. He's hot. He's ticked off. Maybe somebody was pulling a prank on him. All he wanted was some beef jerky. You never really know. But I guess when you think of monsters and mysteries, you always think of the forest. These dark, scary places. You don't really think about the desert. But it's...
Yeah.
It seems like there's just as many mysteries there as there is other places, whether you're in the water, whether you're in the forest. And it makes you wonder, you know, this is kind of what I thought of as a theory, is because the desert, you know, deserts are really hard to cross now.
Mm-hmm.
People die all the time, like I brought up in the segment, even Evan Tanner,
yep.
Guy who knew what he was doing, he died. Happens all the time. I can imagine that long ago, it was even scarier because you didn't have Google Maps. You didn't have Google Earth. You didn't know. So when you came to the front of a desert... And you wanted to go across it, you really didn't know how long of a journey that would be.
Well, yeah,
so
like we talked about.
It would be hard with your trying to figure water or food or whatever. So were a lot of these stories created to keep people out of the desert simply so that they wouldn't die? And so they made up, you know, this culture made up to this legend. This culture makes up this legend, this story, this sighting.
Yeah.
As a play to, as a way to lure people away. Don't go in there. Or because it's so desolate and there aren't that many humans there... Are these spirits and specters and things drawn to those areas, like Sasquatch, I guess, because no one's going to be in there messing with them because it's a very desolate place. I mean, I know there are humans that live in deserts. It happens.
Yes.
But for most deserts, even though there are people, they're not that inhabited. Most of them are pretty desolate.
Well, and I also wonder, too, is it stories that are told by people that were just trying to survive? Maybe they had some visions or something while they were out there, like on their walkabout out in that thing.
Right, you know, you always see the cartoon of the Oasis where people rubbing their eyes and they see palm trees, and, you know, and then they get there and there's nothing there,
there's nothing
or they
there.
Start drinking and it's not water, it's sand. You know, you see there's even cartoons that show that.
I can't
Could it
imagine.
Be the same thing? I don't know.
But like you said, that's a heck of a gamble back then. To get there. I mean, it's a heck of a gamble now, but I mean, back then when you knew nothing, you know, because I'm thinking about all the preparation I did on that one little trip we took this weekend.
Yeah.
Of just, you know, you've got your maps, you've got your times, you've got your watching your watch, you've got everything that you need. And you know, I mean, yeah, it could have, I mean, we're a pretty good ways from people. I mean, there's no cell phone service. There's no anything out there. So if something goes bad, you're going to have to walk a ways to get a little help. But there's people
still,
on the river.
Yeah.
But it's not like a couple hundred years ago, even, or even 50 or 60, to come up to a desert.
And not know how far it goes.
And go, is it just right over that hill? Or if I go left, is it desert for the next 200 miles?
Yeah. Or maybe, like you're saying, maybe if I go straight forward, the desert's only 25 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go south, it's 700 miles.
Exactly.
I don't know. You don't know. And I always think of like Lewis and Clark, these early explorers or people going on the Oregon Trail. When you're going down a path, and you got to remember, like I said, there's no Google Maps or anything. You're just going off like a letter somebody sent you and said, hey,
and
we're in San Francisco. Come this way.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you start coming to the Teton Mountains or something. You got to be like, is it just a set of mountains when I get over the other side will be clear, or is it the next 300 miles is nothing but mountains?
Like
I
when
don't
they got
know.
To the top of the Rockies, and you look and it's just mountains.
I mean, that's got to be terrifying.
Yeah, especially
Thank
if you're
God
not
we
prepared.
Didn't have to do that, right? Same thing with the oceans. Pretty pretty cool. But there's also been some scary activity. We've been keeping up with this a little bit on the show, but when it comes to Mothman in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
Lon is still getting information sent to him. Pretty interesting.
Well, Manuel Navarrete over there at the UFO Clearinghouse has been in contact with Lon, and Lon keeps posting this stuff up, and we keep going back to it. So I'm letting all of y'all tie into this whole thing. Like I said, go over there and check Lon's page at Phantoms and Monsters. Go dig through all that stuff to catch yourself up on everything. These are a couple that just went down. He received this. It says, "I would like to tell you about an incident that happened on Saturday, May 27th of 2017 near our home in Chicago. We were returning home after going out to dinner with some friends at the neighborhood Thai food restaurant. The time was about 10:30-ish at night, and we were walking hand in hand towards home. As we approached the intersection of Wrightwood and Lakeview, North Wrightwood Avenue and North Lakeview Avenue, my husband noticed something flying above us headed towards the west. It was flying approximately 15 feet in the air and moving along at a very brisk pace. It looks like a giant bat, only it was way larger and solid black. The object would have been almost solid black if it were not for the two glowing red eyes staring back at us."
Right, and that seems to be common.
Uh-huh.
With this, whatever they're seeing.
Whatever this is. It says it flew overhead, circled back, flew over us again before heading back to the park, or towards the park. So this object was far larger than anything I have ever seen in and around the park, or even the lakefront. I've seen large birds in the area, but could recognize them as birds as nothing grew even close to the size of this thing. My husband said that whatever it was not of this world, and if it was, it was undiscovered. But he was absolutely speechless and could not provide an explanation for what we saw. And it goes on to say that we discussed it all the way home, and afterwards I did some searching on the internet for a possible explanation when I ran across report sightings, and some of them very close to our neighborhood. And then, you know, they go on talking about some of the things that had happened and how they were looking at it. They weren't aware, much like we, you know, everybody else, that this was going on until they went to pull it up and found this. But here's another one. Here's one that went down the 23rd of June, just this past Friday at 9:30, right by the Alder Planetarium there in Chicago. Says, "My girlfriend and I are spending the weekend in Chicago, and we took a walk around the Alder and Shedd Aquarium so she could try to get some more Pokemon." That's right. Apparently people are still playing Pokemon.
Well, that phase died off quickly. Yeah. The Pokemon Go, remember that?
Says, "We were spending our anniversary together downtown and wanted to visit the museum campus. We were at the backside of the Alder Planetarium and had walked along the path toward the food court. We ordered some food and sat down, when there was commotion and a bunch of people were shouting and pointing at the sky. Now, we both got up and went to look at what was going on and saw a large black bat-like creature headed away from us. When we asked people what they had seen, we were told that they had seen a large bat. Now, everyone described it as a large bat-like creature that also had human-like features. Now, what we saw was flying away from us, but supported what everyone else has seen, looking like a large bat. Now, we hung around for about 30 minutes after that, looking up in the sky as everyone else was. No one saw or heard anything for the remainder of the time that we were there. There was a feeling of uneasiness amongst the people who were there, and many shortly departed right before we did." Yeah, so there's two sightings that have happened.
Yeah, so what is going on in Chicago? Yeah.
Well, that's what's great. The red eye one sighting was almost a month ago.
Yeah.
You know, and now this other bat sighting. We need to talk to Kevy Kev, because I know they were kicking it in Chicago over the week and whatnot, and I know for a fact that he was at the Alder Planetarium, so this may be some no-good stuff Kevy's up to.
That's pretty crazy, though, that these sightings keep rolling in.
They just keep coming, man. You know, and look, I know we all, it's all speculation. This whole show, I know we've said this time and time again. Is it just people that are jumping on the bandwagon? They're just reporting it because, you know, they want to be part of it and the whole thing. But the trouble is this. I understand making up a story to get on television. I understand trying to be interviewed by a local news station or a large news affiliate. So I get that. You know, you want to have your 5 minutes of fun on TV. Right. I understand that. But when you're not getting any television time, for you're not getting anything at all other than just writing a story, it's hard for me to believe that someone wants to go to the trouble to make up not only a sighting that's all we saw was it was flying away from us. That's all we saw. And everybody talked about how it was a large bat with some human-like characteristics. Why would you make up that whole bunch of stuff if all you saw was it flying away from you? I just don't know that. I mean, I understand there's a lot of trolls out there and all this stuff. I get that. But it seems like it's either there's something going on or everybody's jumping on the bandwagon of BS.
I agree with you. And there's no telling, but I think that there's something going on. Pretty cool. Yeah. Before we get out of here, I'd like to remind everybody about our sponsor, Gaia. That's GAIA.com. It's a video streaming service. You can go over there right now. They have three different plans to choose from, a three-month plan, a monthly plan, and an annual plan. If you sign up now, your first month is only 99 cents, but you got to use our code. That's Gaia.com/expanded perspectives, all one word, GAIA.com/expanded perspectives. Cam, what do you got planned for your week?
Man, oh man. Well, like I said, I'm going to watch a little bit of the fights this evening. I'm fixing to go to a cookout, and then the rest of this week, I don't know. Probably trying to bust some stuff out and then get ready for the wedding Saturday. So that's about all we've got.
Right on. I'm going to be redoing this baseball tournament that got rained out, the same rainstorm that you and Brandy got caught up in on your trip. Actually blew through here, and you got all our games canceled. So we're supposed to be rescheduling and doing that this week. I'm not sure if that means in the middle of the week, if that means next weekend. I don't really know. So I'm going to have to play it by ear. But that's all I've got planned, that and work.
Yeah.
So for all you Elite members, I guess we'll be speaking to you on Friday. For everybody else, we'll talk to you again next Monday. For Gaia, Pretty Lights, Inner Tradition Books, New Island Books, Anomalous Books, and Ancient American Magazine, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.